Hi, it's Aaron from Gangland Wire. When Gary's not here, I break open the beef jerky, but not just any jerky. I break open the Jurassic Jerky. That's right. Go on over to JurassicJerkyLLC.com and put in your order for some tasty snack meat treats. If you love beef jerky, then you've got to get the carnivore candy from Jurassic Jerky. Put in the promo code GANG10 and you'll get 10% off the entire purchase order. There's my order coming in now.
Evening, folks. You are listening to Gangland Wire, and we love this podcast in Scotland.
So when they take the silver dollar, they gotta go around a different bank.
Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced 4 documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Gangland Wire True Crime Stories is produced at the Big Dumb Fun Show Studio 4. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Well, welcome all you wiretappers out there. We're here in the classic old ice house in Midtown Kansas City. I'm here with my good friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
Well, folks, this is going to be our second episode, part 2 of The Westies. Maybe I'll title this The Westies, the Irish mob in Manhattan, New York City. I got an email, it was highly complimentary about our podcast. He said we were the best true crime mob podcast going today, and his name is Dean. Thank you, Dean. Dean from Ireland, and Dean wanted some stories on the Irish mob in the United States, so I'm obliging him.
You certainly did.
And it's really interesting. Now, we started last week, we started with Oney Madden, and if you ever saw the movie The Streets of New York, that kind of tells some of the real early story of the Irish gangs fighting with the Protestant gangs for domination of different territories, neighborhoods. Man who came over in, 1902, Oney Madden, and he joined a little gang called the Gophers, which was actually a pretty good-sized gang, and had killed somebody and became known as the killer by the time he was 18 years old and served some time in the penitentiary. And he came out of the penitentiary during Prohibition, right after Prohibition started in 1930, and of course, Prohibition really is responsible for modern organized crime today because it allowed people to organize around a distribution network that was highly profitable, and that was the alcohol business. So he got involved in Prohibition, and he made a lot of money, and he did well.
He was making $200 a day.
Yeah, and that was like $2,000 a day today. So he was doing well. And that was early in his career. Later on, he was no telling how much he was making. He ends up getting into a lot of conflicts with the Italian mobs, the five families in New York City. And by the 1930s, middle to later 30s, they were getting really, really powerful because of Prohibition and some of their other rackets, primarily gambling. But Prohibition was making them a lot of money, and he was... he was at odds with them. He would not give in to them. They wanted to at least have him do their bidding, sell their booze to, or at least give them a piece of his action. We don't know exactly what it was. He ends up leaving town. He moves to, where was it? Hot Springs, Arkansas. That's crazy. But Hot Springs, Arkansas was a wide open city. It was 1935. It was a wide open city back then. He has a club down there, and a lot of Northeast New York City mobsters will vacation down in Hot Springs because there's open gambling and horse racing. Oney Madden will live out his life and die of natural causes in 1965. During the war, 1941, 42, 43, Oney's gone. Irish mobsters are really kind of forced to work with the Italians, and then they can't really resist the Italians. There's a man named Hugh Mulligan that kind of is the boss. Hugh Mulligan brings in a guy named Michael Spillane, or Mickey Spillane. Mickey Spillane is what they say is the last of the gentleman gangsters. He was the kind of guy who was married to a prominent Irish politician, Irish-American politician in New York City. He was married to the guy's daughter. Name was McManus.
Eugene McManus. That wasn't the daughter.
No, I don't know what the daughter's name. I can't remember her name.
Maureen McManus.
Maureen. Go back and listen. You'll find out. No, I'm just kidding.
It's kind of funny. You're like, here's my wife, Eugene.
Here's my wife, Eugene. Anyhow, you're digressing me here, shall we say, as I do a little recap to get us up to Jimmy Coonan. Mickey Spillane, not the private detective Mickey Spillane. Mickey Spillane, real good-looking guy and real charismatic, and he's running all the rackets on the west side, and he refuses to let the Italians in. He squeezes them back out, and they have a big construction project going on with we'll have contracts to be let that Italians want to have some of their friends who have construction companies get a piece of this action. And Mickey Spillane, he's already got this connection with the with his Irish American politician father-in-law, so he's getting a lot of that, and he's not sharing with the Italians. And it's a Jacob Javits Convention Center in Madison Square Garden, and all that's going in, and it's in the West Side, in the Westies territory, what we call Hell's Kitchen. They are really angry, and they end up hiring a guy, Jimmy Coonan, we'll talk about Jimmy Coonan. That's what we're going to talk about today.
It was so interesting, because there was two different families kind of, if you will, vying around, trying, it seemed, to get get that power and control of those various concessions. One of those being the Genovese family that was interested in the Javits Center and Madison Square Gardens. And then there was the Gambino family, who was the family that Coonan threw in with.
Right, is the Gambino. He probably got to know this Gambino member, Roy DeMeo, for some reason, and so Jimmy Coonan, he was already mad at. He didn't like Mickey Spillane. Partly it went all the way back to his childhood. His father, Jimmy Coonan's father, was an accountant and not really involved in criminal activity. And I think I said this last week. He had been kidnapped for ransom by Mickey Spillane or somebody connected to Mickey Spillane, his gang, and somebody pistol whipped Coonan's father during this. And Coonan had held a grudge against Mickey Spillane ever since. Now he'd killed a Spillane lieutenant in say 1965, 66. Another thing he did in 1966, Jimmy Coonan was a little bit crazy. He bought a machine gun, some kind of a smaller machine gun, maybe a Tommy gun or a Sten gun, I'm not sure what. By 1966, it could have been an AR-15 or an M-16. Actually, guys were coming back from Vietnam and smuggling guns back, too. By that point in time, he got on top of a Hell's Kitchen tenement building there on the west side of Manhattan. He knew Mickey Spillane and some of his men were inside of a bar, and he just waited till they left this bar. And when they walked out of the bar, he fired a 30-round magazine in one long burst at these guys. They were all like scrambling and ducking and running for cover. And he didn't even wound one man, but they said Spillane got the message that Jimmy Coonan was not to be taken lightly. He tried again in 1969 to kill Spillane. He was arrested on some, during this time, Coonan was arrested on some other murder and kidnapping charges. He was able to bargain these down to, I get this, a disorderly conduct felony charge and a manslaughter felony charge. I would say the fix was in on that deal. But he did do a little bit of prison time. This is 1969, and he was in prison for a couple of years, 1971, came back out, and he was recruiting guys to form a crew, and he wanted to take over the neighborhood from Mickey Spillane, and he knew he had to throw in with the Italians, and he knew this Roy DeMeo. Somehow he'd gotten to know Roy DeMeo, who was a Gambino family member, and he threw in with him. And I'm the Genovese family wanted to just completely destroy all of Mickey Spillane's Irish criminal organization. They wanted to kill each and every one of them. Now, the story goes that Mickey Spillane had around 70 members in his gang that were under his control that could be identified. The Genovese crime family recruited a team of 300 hitmen, and they wanted to kill every member of Spillane's gang. They ended up killing a total of 68 members of Spillane's gang, and shooting them with AK-47s and other kinds of pistols. They even used a hand grenade on one. They had an Uzi on another deal and shotguns. And about 30 of them were killed by bombings. In the aftermath of this...
Wait, so out of 70 members, they lose 68 of them.
Yeah, Mickey Spillane's already been killed. Remember, he was decoyed out in front of his apartment building, and somebody killed him. And then they killed all the rest of his organized crime family.
And a lot of them weren't even Irish.
Probably not, yeah.
I think from the episode before, you didn't say pistol whipped when you talked about Coonan's dad.
Oh, yeah, I forgot about that before.
You didn't say that, so that's kind of new news.
Yeah, I'd forgot about that before. So we're kind of going back over some of them. Now we're going to go into totally new stuff. All this killing of the 70 members of the Spillane organization by the 300 members of Genovese. That's all new news here. The other was kind of repeating. I added a little bit to it because of my notes. I have two separate sets of notes here.
Well, I mean, that just sounds like that's like war on the streets of New York.
Pretty much. Genovese crime family took over all of Spillane's construction business, all of his organized crime business, and any other kind of criminal activity in Hell's Kitchen. But they brought Jimmy Coonan in. He worked with them. Jimmy Coonan recruited his own gang of young Irish hoods, and they started kidnapping, beating, and murdering anybody that they suspected had ever been loyal to Mickey Spillane. Now, one of his new recruits will be their undoing. The 24-year-old Vietnam vet by the name of Mickey Featherstone. And he really became Coonan's right-hand man during this time. Hell's Kitchen in the Irish community was kind of a small community, and even the local businessmen and store owners and everything, you kind of had to, if you're going to stay there, you had to choose sides. Were you going to be on the Westies and Jimmy Coonan, or are you going to be loyal to the old Spillane faction, most of whom are dead now? Anybody that took Spillane's side, they beat them up, they kidnapped them, they vandalized their stores, they robbed them. Anybody that chose Coonan's side was pretty much immune, because anybody left that was from any kind of retaliation, because most of anybody left from Spillane's gang were older and they weren't really up for all this kind of crazy stuff. Mickey Featherstone was the worst of them, all of them. He was a complete nutcase. He came from the Upper West Side. He was born on West 43rd Street. One of these Irish families had 9 kids. I always find this interesting. His mother had regular square john jobs. His mother worked for the VFW, and his father was a U.S. Customs officer. He was blonde-haired, and I've seen pictures of him. He's kind of baby-faced. Didn't look like any kind of a killer at all. He got drafted, and he wanted to kill so bad that 1966 he volunteered for combat in Vietnam. And I don't think you really had to do much volunteering to get to combat in Vietnam. He claimed that he joined the special forces. I don't think he ever did, but he said he joined the special forces and killed a lot of people when he was in Vietnam duty. He was assigned to some kind of support duties with the special forces, probably like getting, you know, resupplying their bullets and stuff like that. But he was connected to them, but he wasn't really a Green Beret. There's kind of an interesting story that came out of this. He was uncircumcised when he went over there, and he got drunk one night with a bunch of medics and passed out. When he woke up, he found that they had given him a circumcision. I guess, you know, if you're really drunk and then somebody shoots some like
morphine
or maybe does, and then does a topical kind of a painkiller on your skin down there around your penis, I guess they could do that. I don't know. It's kind of a wild-ass story, but I found it two or three places, so I don't know. I don't have direct...
Well, here your notes say he received a medical discharge in 1967.
You know, just a year later.
Is that because of he was traumatized by a circumcision?
Well, he supposedly had hallucinations, too. I don't know.
I bet he did. He kept waking up thinking he was going to find his foreskin.
This might be why he was so crazy later on. He was the kind of guy, he achieved neighborhood fame. You know, again, this Hell's Kitchen is kind of a small place. It's like a small town in many ways. There's some outsiders went into one of the Hell's Kitchen's bar, and he got in some kind of argument with them. So he just left, came back with a rifle, and shot one of them. He got arrested, but somehow he got probation. He must not have killed him.
This must have been after he came back from Vietnam.
Yeah, oh yeah. 1971, he got in another barroom brawl, and he shot and killed a man named Linwood Willie. Sounds like a black guy more than likely, but in this case, he was found not guilty due to insanity, but he did spend some time, he spent four years in a series of different mental hospitals. While he was incarcerated, he had to be restrained, and they ended up putting Thorazine on him and get that Thorazine shuffle and just kind of walk down the street and carefully place one foot in front of the other, walking really slow. After he got out, he started going back to the joints and hanging out with his old buddies in the Westies gang. He had such a penchant for violence and intimidation of anybody around him that Coonan knew that he could use this guy, and he brought him in. 1977, Mickey Spillane was finally killed. Featherstone was arrested but acquitted for this killing. The FBI and the police suspect him of committing a series of mob contract killings during the next few years. He actually went on trial with Jimmy Coonan for killing a bar owner named Harold Whited, and they were acquitted in 1979 after one witness killed himself and another refused to testify. During the 1970s, Coonan was an enforcer and a bodyguard for a Jewish loan shark, Ruby Stein. Coonan decided he wanted to take over Ruby Stein's business. Ruby Stein had been protected by Mickey Spillane. He decided he'd just have Stein murder, and he wanted to get his... Black Book, of course, with all of his bookies and gamblers and everything he learned about the business, so he could just take it over. And there's a lot of Westies own money to Stein, and they would like to get out of these obligations. So he wanted the Black Book. So he had he actually had people who were friends or supposed friends of Ruby Stein's who would then help set him up.
Maybe they weren't friends. They were gamblers.
Gamblers, yeah. They were gamblers.
Bad gamblers, right. At that. But good shots.
And Coonan would promise to forgive any of their debts when he got hold of the Black Book. Sounds like almost like a TV show, doesn't it? You get hold of the Black Book with everybody's debts in it, and if you help him do it, then he'll just erase your debt out of the Black Book. Ruby Stein was lured to the 596 Club Bar on the west side, and they had it set up. This was like a bar controlled by the Westies, and they killed him there and dragged his corpse into the bathroom and started cutting him up and dragging his body parts off piece by piece and dumped him in the Hudson River. But, you know, Coonan wasn't, he ended up kind of refining this technique of cutting people up and disposing of their body later on, but he didn't do it so good then. Coonan, they put the torso in the Hudson River, but they didn't puncture the lungs. They just threw it in, and the lungs will hold air, and he bobbed up and washed ashore, so... But this was kind of the beginning of this, like a signature of Jimmy Coonan and the Westies, that how they kill somebody and then they take sharp knives and cut their bodies up into different pieces and then go spread them out in different places. Coonan had kind of a sense of humor. Supposedly, when he bought a new home, he walked up in front of it with some other guys and he just turned and exclaimed out loud, "Thanks, Rudy." As he was making a lot of money having Rudy's loan shark business.
I would think Rudy would have been a little nervous to begin with, given that all the Spillane's men were being wiped out.
Really? I know. I can't imagine how you live this life, Aaron, especially at this point in time in the west side of New York City, and you got all these killings are going on. It's just crazy. Another good story about Coonan. I mean, he was a cold-blooded dude. He once killed a loan shark victim. He's kind of like Mad Sam DiStefano, who couldn't pay his debt, dismembered him, and cut off his hands. Then he put the hands in a bag in a freezer, and he was going to use them later on to put these fingerprints on a gun that he was going to use to commit another murder. He learned how to dismember murder victims from a fellow Westies member who had trained as a butcher in the penitentiary. And then he'd always throw them out into the East River rather than the Hudson River. Hudson River wasn't running quite as fast, so they might bob up to the top, I guess.
Yeah, or at least after that first one did.
Really. He continued with his alliance with the Westies and the Gambino organization. By this time, Paul Castellano is the head of the Gambino family, and his main contact was Roy DeMeo, as we talked about before. Between these two guys, I don't know which one was the worst killer, and they had a stranglehold on the racketeering activities in Hell's Kitchen. Now, Mickey Featherstone was going to bring him down. He goes to jail. He's got some counterfeit money, and he uses it as a massage parlor. Well, one of the girls of police come, or the Secret Service, who investigates, counterfeit money, they go, and they start interviewing the girls at the massage parlor, and one of them remembers a guy that was in there that night that gave out this, but probably passed this money, and he had his name tattooed on his forearm, Featherstone. So they put him in jail for this counterfeiting charge. He's sent back to the medical center, Springfield, in the psychiatric ward in 1982. He becomes a model prisoner. He does stuff like he has a perfectly made bunk bed to pass any inspections. He gets on other people for not polishing their doorframe brass and keeps everything perfect. He's working on the ward all the time, keep him out of general population, in particular, they said, for his own safety. He's sounded like he's such a nutcase, I don't know. He ends up getting 6 years for the counterfeiting charge.
Didn't they have a lot of the Italians that would end up going up, and they would use insanity as a charge, so then they would go into a similar kind of a mental facility for a duration? Is it possible that there were, given who he was and his connection with New York, that his own safety was because other people were going to exact a little payback?
Probably because he had been so crazy in New York that I'm not sure.
These mutilations have to have gotten the street,
But I think he was killing mainly other Irish people.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure why he was kept out of general population, what the deal was, but he ends up getting 6 years.
I was going to say, because I could understand why he'd be a model prisoner. He was in the military.
Yeah.
Anybody could make a tight bunk.
Yeah.
The guy that was in the special forces. But nobody made fun of his foreskin.
Really? Yeah, really. By 1980, Jimmy Coonan's back in jail on a gun possession charge, and Mickey Featherstone's in jail on the counterfeiting rap. But the Westies, they left an organization behind. You can still have those organizations running even though you're in the penitentiary. And they're running all the gambling, loan sharking, and union shakedown activities in the west side of Manhattan and Hell's Kitchen. His Gambino contact, Roy DeMeo, was murdered during this time. And he's kind of Coonan's Gambino family connection becomes a Daniel Marino, who is a capo from Brooklyn. Coonan will eventually, he gets a little closer to top, and he'll eventually interact directly with John Gotti, who has, in 1985, he has Paul Castellano killed, which is a huge deal and really a big shock to the New York Five families that Gotti would kill his boss so he could become the boss. But he ended up getting away with it, and he became the boss. So really the Westies during this time will end up working for the Gambino crime family as kind of their lone personal contract killer squad. When you got somebody like Coonan running them, and you got all these guys they've trained in how to cut up bodies and get rid of bodies. Coonan and Featherstone end up falling out. Featherstone did not like him kowtowing and connecting with the Italian mafia so much. He thought that he ought to just stay with his own kind and not work with these Italians. Coonan and Mickey Featherstone have a falling out. And what happens, they want to get rid of Featherstone. And I guess they don't want to kill him, but what they do is they set him up. They frame him for the murder of a guy named Michael Holly. Now, Michael Holly is a guy that had he was a construction worker, but he also was a neighborhood bar owner, and he had refused to give these Westies any protection money.
And that makes Holly an enemy of the Westies.
Right. Now, one night in his bar, one of the Westies shot Michael Holly. Now, he just wounded him. And then there's an off-duty policeman that happened to be in there, and he shoots and kills John Bokum, who is one of the Westies, one of Coonan's people. And the Westies blamed Holly for that death, and they wanted to kill Holly. They used John Bokum's brother, Billy Bokum, who wore a wig and a mustache so he looked like Featherstone. He rented a car that was identical to one Mickey Featherstone drove all the time. And they murdered this Holly, you know, in broad daylight on West 35th Street. So Mickey Featherstone became the prime suspect. He ended up, by 1986, Mickey Featherstone was convicted of the murder of Michael Holly, even though he was innocent.
Let me get this straight, just so I get it. So I understand. So Holly, you know, he's a construction worker. He's a local bar owner there in the Hell's Kitchen. And this guy who's John Bokum comes in to shoot.
He shoots Michael Holly.
Michael Holly.
And wounds him.
But doesn't kill him.
Doesn't kill him.
There's an off-duty officer there at the bar who is able to pull his gun. He shoots and kills John Bokum.
Right, who's a Westie who worked for Jimmy Coonan.
Yeah, and then the Westies blame Holly for the death of John Bokum. So what they do is they dress up somebody who happens to be John Bokum's brother.
Right, right. Mickey Featherstone.
Mickey Featherstone. And then they must have set up a meeting with...
Michael Holly.
They set up a meeting with Michael Holly.
Or they catch him walking down the street. They follow him or something, catch him walking down the street with a lot of witnesses around. And he's got a wig and a mustache, so he looks like Mickey Featherstone. He's driving a car that's identical to Mickey Featherstone's car.
Mm-hmm.
And he shoots and kills Holly. So the first thing the police do... Once they get that car description and that physical description from witnesses, then they go out and arrest Mickey Featherstone. Well, this is 1985, I guess. 1986, Mickey Featherstone is convicted for this murder, even though he's totally innocent of it. And he gets 25 years in the penitentiary, and he's figured it out by now, or somebody's told him, or he's figured it out that they framed him. They set him up on this deal.
So, well, despite killing a lot of people, Mickey Featherstone probably knew he didn't kill.
Right. He killed a lot of people, but he knew he didn't kill Michael Holly.
Yeah.
He knew somebody set him up, and probably he had some friend or some source in the gang that tipped him to, here's what really happened, dude.
So as a result of that.
So rather than serving that 25 years, he gets hold of the prosecutor and says, okay, here's what happened. Here's who committed the murder, and I will cooperate and help you take down all these guys. He becomes an informant. Even his wife, since he's in the penitentiary, they need somebody out on the street to try to get some incriminating conversations with some of these gang guys, either on the phone or face-to-face. So Featherstone's wife is a gal named Sissy. I don't know who would be married to this guy, but, you know, there's always somebody for everybody, you know. Sissy cooperates too, and she wears a wire on some of these other Coonan gang members, including Billy Bokum, who's the one that actually did the murder. By the end of '86, September of '86, the judge in New York overturns Featherstone's murder conviction, and he'll end up testifying against Jimmy Coonan at a racketeering trial in 1987, and all these other mobsters, anybody he knows anything about, and his wife does too, and she's got him on tape. Put them all in the penitentiary. Featherstone pleads guilty to one racketeering charge and gets a suspended sentence, 5 years probation. And he ends up getting freed by 1988, and he's still in the witness protection program.
Along with his wife, Sissy.
Along with his wife, Sissy. Now, what's kind of interesting, Rudy Giuliani was the big... organized crime prosecutor in the 1980s in New York City, and he tried to get Gotti during the same time. He had a big Gotti task force going, trying to get Gotti, and wiretapped him and did all kinds of stuff. He's the one that prosecuted Jimmy Coonan and the rest of the Westies under RICO, or racketeer influence and corrupt organizations, And they really, they took them, they went back for the last 20 years and looked at all their different criminal activities. And Mickey Featherstone had been involved with them for probably 10 or 12 of those years, maybe even 15. And he testified for 4 weeks.
4 weeks.
4 weeks in September and got them all convicted. Jimmy Coonan, he got 60 years in prison. A lot of the rest of them, here's another, Jimmy McElroy, was a top enforcer, got 60 years. Muggsy Ritter, that's a good name. It sounds like the Bowery Boys there, Richard Muggsy Ritter. He got 40 years for loan sharking and dealing drugs. I don't know what happened to those other two, but Coonan's still serving his time in Lewisburg. And Featherstone, if he's still alive, is in the witness protection program. So that was kind of the end. That was the end of the Westies, really. Mickey Featherstone took them all down.
Well, but at that point, then it just basically got taken over by the Gambinos.
Gambinos, they were already like a crew
working for the Gambinos.
Yeah, they were just a crew working for the Gambinos.
Now, the Lewisburg Federal Penitentiary. I wonder how old would Coonan be. I think we had not said when he was born at the very beginning.
He would be, I think he was born in 1946. I think he was born right after the war.
December 21, 1946.
Yeah, so he would be about 69 or 70. I think he's still alive, probably is. I wonder,
he would be
Lewisburg,
like 71, wouldn't he?
Yeah, something like that. Lewisburg is, that's where Tuffy DeLuna was in during this time. I know I had a picture of Tuffy with a couple other northeastern Italian mobsters and a guy named Winter from the Winter Hill Mob in Boston. He would have known Coonan. Of course, he's dead too, so we can't go ask him.
Maybe we could put some money on Coonan's books. He could give us a call.
He could call us. Yeah, that would be interesting. That'd be an interesting phone call, wouldn't it?
I mean, he's not getting out.
These guys are pretty scary, though, Aaron.
Yeah, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the mob in the late 70s, early 80s, into the 90s.
Yeah, who knows? Who knows what it would like to be worth a shot? You can find those guys, and you can get there easy to find them. I didn't, I forgot to look him up in the federal prison.
Yeah, because you could find out, you can find out his numbers.
You get his number and the address of the phone, and you can just send him a letter, and, they can either respond to it or not. That's how these newspaper people are.
Novelists.
People like that, novelists, they go into these penitentiaries and interview people sometimes. He would be an interesting guy. So that's the story of the Westies, folks, from Dean, I hope you're happy with this, from 1902 to the last known activities of the Westies in about 1987 or 88. A long and storied career. I'm always surprised. I wonder if we ever had an Irish crime family here.
In Kansas City. As we talk about the Irish mob, and I mean, we're really talking about it in the American sense, in the history of the Irish mob
right here
in America, but was there not an Irish mob in Ireland?
No, there were Irish professional criminals, I'm sure, but...
It wasn't organized in the same way or crude?
Not that I know. I don't know anything about it. I know a little more about the English and how they were set up into different crews. Different little organizations or families, like the Cray twins, and they had an organization.
Maybe
I think there was, but there was more than one. They don't really lend themselves, I don't think, to having one big organization with a titular head to it.
Yeah, it would break it up into regions. But yeah. Maybe that would be a question for Dean.
Yeah, Dean, let us know about Irish crime families. What's going on over there in Ireland? Suggest a book or something.
Not necessarily now, but historically.
Yeah, historically. Yeah, we don't. It's all different now. I think Colombian drug gangs are running everything now, or Russian mafia dudes, or something like that. Everything's changed so much. Just the mob's just not like it used to be. Organized crime is just not like it used to be, is it, Aaron?
It's not nearly as fun.
Not nearly.
Is that what
as
you're
fun.
Saying?
when it started? It started when they started wearing gold chains around their neck and tracksuits.
That was a disco era.
That was a disco era brought down the mob, I'd say.
I don't know. You have to think, because the internet and information age makes it really difficult. But, kind of racketeering seems like a potential avenue for income, prostitution, obviously, illegal gambling, Maybe, you know, obviously illegal drugs. I don't know if that was good or bad for the mob, but, you know, working the docks and being able to, you know, jack the freight, so to speak, like they did with the Lufthansa heist. Obviously, when they got $6 million, they were not expecting that.
No, they weren't. That's a good one there. That money never really showed up either anywhere that anybody really knows about. It's kind of like the Greenlease ransom. All of a sudden, you know, it just disappears.
Just disappears.
Nobody knows what happened. It's crazy, crazy, crazy.
Probably the Gopher Gang, they just buried it.
Yeah. I got a picture that I'll put in my website page on this that has a picture of these grubby-faced little Irish kids. It's the Gopher Gang. Oney Madden is one of them. I don't know how they found that picture. It's a pretty good picture.
It must be pretty old.
Oh, yeah, 1915. See, he came over here at age 10. I was probably 1902. He was probably like 1910 then, because he was six or seven then, so he was a teenager, I believe.
Yeah, when he's shooting and killing people with a lead pipe and a gun.
Yeah, well, that's different kind of a high school experience for Oney Madden than it was for me and you, Aaron.
Yeah, not exactly track and field.
Really? When they threw a javelin, they threw it at somebody.
Yeah.
When they had a shot put, they put it upside your head.
Yeah.
The discus.
They were running numbers. They weren't actually running.
Really? I think we've done this in. If you have a friend or relative or a loved one that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. What do you got to say to that, Aaron?
I got to say, folks, you need to go out and get the documentary that started it all, Gangland Wire, available on Amazon to rent or buy. And, of course, you want to buy it because you want to watch it over and over again. Some of the great details, some of the great recordings, original words from the mouth of the men that did it. And then, of course, you want to get the Kansas City Mob Tour app. You, for $1.99, can take your own personalized tour of notorious mob locations in and around Kansas City. You can listen to the podcast while you're doing that, or you can get Gary's latest book,
Leaving Vegas,
234. Leaving Vegas.
How FBI wiretaps ended mob domination of Las Vegas casinos.
You can get the paperback, but get the Kindle as well, because there's hyperlinks to the original audio, and you will hear it from the mouth of the men that did it.
Really? Say goodnight, Aaron.
Goodnight, Aaron. Music provided by Odd-O-Matic. Find them on Facebook at Odd-O-Matic Music.